From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Director Alan Hughes had a rocky history with Tupac Shakur, so when he was offered the chance to make a documentary series about the much-mythologized rapper, he hesitated.
I always thought it would be a great idea. I just didn't know if I was ready for it. Took a few days to think about it, and I go, you know what? No better way for me to understand the misunderstandings that even the public has with this guy. He's one of the most misunderstood figures of the 20th century.
Alan Hughes talks to NPR TV critic and my friend, Eric Deggans, about being assaulted by Shakur just weeks before his 1993 debut feature, Menace to Society, premiered at Cannes. He also explains why including the story of Tupac's mother was integral to the docuseries. But first, two buddies banter while I'm away. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So let's talk about Paramount for a minute. Paramount announced some earnings that were disappointing to Wall Street, and their stock got pummeled. They are in a tough spot right now. I mean, the people I'm talking to at the highest levels of Hollywood feel like they're in a sort of a trap, that they are too small and they're not going to be able to get big enough. And that having a hit like Yellowstone, which airs on the Paramount Network, but then goes to Peacock, not Paramount Plus, just that one hit, as big as it is, does not turn into a strategy for them. They just shuttered MTV News. They're looking to cut costs, but they were clobbered in the comeback. I don't know. It seems like maybe they can do this on their own for a few years. But, you know, Sherry Redstone, people have said, has been looking to shop the company, but she wants to maintain control. And it's hard at this point to think who would buy it, even if she didn't completely have control.
Yeah, I mean, the stock dropped 30% in a day after these earnings. That's not great. This is a once proud big media company that is only worth about $11, $12 billion these days. And considering they got an offer for Showtime only at $3 billion, and they're now trying to sell BET for somewhere in the $3 to $4 billion range, it doesn't show a lot of confidence in the full company on the part of Wall Street that it's not valued very much higher than those assets. They just have these linear television networks that are being really pummeled by this ad recession, and they don't have enough profitability on the streaming side because the cost of doing all these shows is so high. So they're on this kind of like double-weighted seesaw, and it's going to break in the middle probably.
Yeah, I mean, I think they kind of jumped into the streaming wars just as Wall Street was prepared to pivot and say, wait a minute, so that Paramount was building subscribers when Wall Street was getting cold on subscribers and wanted to see profit. We knew how Sherry Redstone and her management wanted Tom Cruise to put Top Gun or Mission Impossible, something directly to the streamer or with a narrower window. He's not going to do that for anybody, so they couldn't do that.
Well, and they're lucky he didn't.
Well, right.
I mean, that juiced their earnings last year. They should be so lucky to have a Top Gun Maverick in theaters every summer. We'll see how Mission Impossible does.
Yeah, the early chatter I'm hearing is positive, so I'm sure that will do well, but that will not necessarily solve the problems. Speaking of problems, the writer's strike continues. At this point, we're seeing a lot of SAG-AFTRA members showing up on picket lines, and the Directors Guild has just begun its negotiation. I don't know, Matt, I'm feeling like the Directors Guild is going to make a deal a lot more easily because really they are more focused on money and money alone, whereas the Writers Guild has other issues that they feel threaten their livelihood.
I think that's generally accurate. I think the directors also care about the transparency issue. They would like to supplement the monetary gains with better access to the numbers on how their content performs. They're sort of intertwined there. So we may be looking at a scenario where the directors do make a deal, but they don't make the kind of deal that serves as a full template for the writers. The writers still will have their beef. The directors may settle, and then it comes down to the actors and what they do and whether they can make a deal that would be a template. I still see these writers just being so dug in on the writer-specific issues that it's unclear what impact these other two guilds are even going to have on ending the strike as a whole.
Well, and I know from the studio's point of view, I think they feel they can get to a deal with the Directors Guild, and it would be in their interest to show, like, look, see how reasonable we are. We made a deal with the directors. They are in fear that the actors will go out, of course, because then Hollywood shuts down.
Yeah, it's hard to make content without actors. And then you get into the question, once they shut down, it's a full-on negotiation to get them back. And we look into the fall and maybe even the winter for resolution.
Yeah, that is going to be costly not only for the studios, but for all kinds of people who derive their livelihoods from providing services to the studios. I've heard just a lot of fear that that might happen. But from the people I'm talking to, they don't feel like it's by any means a sure thing. It's just a maybe.
We'll see. No one really knows. Only the people in the room, and we are not there.
And meanwhile, you know, Stranger Things is not going into production, which Netflix had said, we are the ones who can weather the strike the best. Well, Stranger Things, and then, you know, in a bit, it will be Wednesday. We'll see whether that goes into production or not, because, you know, people don't want to cross picket lines. A lot of the showrunners are writer-producers. And as we saw with Tony Gilroy, he had been working on Andor and doing some supposedly non-writing producerial roles. And the guild was like, what are you doing? And he's like, okay, I'm going to stop. I won't do it anymore. So that's where we are. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. Director Alan Hughes had good reason to pass on making a Tupac Shakur documentary, let alone a five-part series about him. After Hughes and his brother Albert fired Shakur from their 1993 debut film Menace to Society, Shakur and some of his associates assaulted Alan, sending him to the hospital with minor injuries. Hughes filed charges, resulting in a 15-day jail sentence. The Hughes brothers had been close friends with Shakur before the incident, directing the rapper's first three music videos in what Hughes calls an intense year-long relationship. 30 years after the assault, Hughes confronts the past with the FX documentary series Dear Mama. The director pairs interviews with Snoop Dogg, Eminem, and Mike Tyson with archival footage of Tupac and his mother, Afeni Shakur, to paint a picture of the complicated artist.
We never spent time together because he was always speaking and going to colleges and everything. And then after that was over, it was more time spent with me. And we were both just like, you're my mother. And she was like, you're my son. And what do we do?
I finally understand for a woman it ain't easy trying to raise a man.
I wanted him to have a place where he found beauty, integrity, and strength within himself.
And there's no way I could pay you back. But my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it.
NPR's Eric Deggans sat down with Alan Hughes to talk about his new series.
I don't know if you remember, but the first time I talked to you about Dear Mama was last year. It was almost a year ago. And I think then the plan was that Dear Mama would come out like at the end of the year or something like that. And so we've seen like release dates kind of shift and stuff. So maybe you could talk a little bit about why the release dates got moved. And also, I mean, once it finally came out, it became the most watched premiere episode for an unscripted series ever on FX. So obviously the delay may have helped, but talk a little bit about the delay and then, you know, seeing people connect with it as viewers.
You know, the delay was, it wasn't ready. And unlike scripted feature films where, you know, it is what it is with documentaries, it's a discovery process. So you never know, it's constantly evolving what it is, you know? And we were meant to come out Mother's Day 2022, and which I thought was the perfect weekend. And man, it was tough to tell them, like, I'm not going to make this. And then they made another date that was in the middle of the year, and I didn't make that date.
Wow.
But, you know, these things, the way I do them, too, is so many layers, so complex to emotionally and narratively and the approach. The good news is what you just said about the, you know, it's been wildly successful with audiences and critics and the culture. And the last episode, part five, will premiere Mother's Day weekend.
Now, for people who know rap history, they might think you would be the last dude to do a docuseries on Tupac, because back in the 90s, he had a gang of guys attack you because he was upset that you and your brother, Albert, fired him from Menace to Society. Can you talk a little bit about how you sort of rounded that corner and got to the point where you were able to talk to his family and the folks who run his estate about actually doing this?
I think I started on the Defiant Ones because Tupac was featured heavily in part three of the Defiant Ones. And that was the first part of like the little emotional unlocking. I was like, well, this guy right here, whew, you know, like I was a fan, but it wasn't until I started cutting with him and realizing something there. And then I had to deal with the estate, had to come in and approve the edit, which was challenging. You know, they were tough and they got to know me. I didn't know the exact, I knew Tom Wally, but I didn't know the others. And I definitely didn't know the family. So when this came to me, I was like, wow, what, you know, that I always thought it would be a great idea. I just didn't know if I was ready for it. Took a few days to think about it. And I go, you know what? No better way for me to understand the misunderstandings that even the public has with this guy. He's one of the most misunderstood figures of the 20th century. So sometimes the reluctant participant is the best one to helm the thing, because you see the journey in the film. You see my journey of painting a portrait of him and his mother.
So when we talked about this last year, we talked a little bit about the assault, and you said that you didn't think that you had even fully processed the trauma of that attack.
Yeah.
And if you don't mind, could you take us back to that time and what happened and what you had to go through to kind of get to the point where you could think about dealing with Tupac again?
Well, what happened was, once he was fired months later, there was a music video for the soundtrack to Menace Society. And he kind of set a trap. I drove up with my brother and a friend, and there he was with the 10, 15 guys already. And then the attack took place. And not even a few weeks after that, we were in Cannes Film Festival. You know, we were the toast of the town, like, with that film. It was highly successful. We were shocked because we weren't happy with the work we did, but the world was reacting to that film the way we would want them to react to the film we wanted to make. And we were everywhere. You know, we were everywhere. We're doing press everywhere, doing everything. So there was no time to think about that. Thank God I didn't break any bones, but I did go to the hospital. I just was always happy that it wasn't my brother that got caught like I did, because right. That would have been a problem for me. You know, there was definitely trauma there, but, you know, big deal. I survived. Who cares? That's the way I look at it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, given that you had already made videos with him, I'm also wondering if you could kind of take us back to when you first met Tupac. And what did you make of this kid? Could you see the artist he was going to become when you first met him? I heard it was in a Waffle House.
Yeah, I was up there meeting Money B and DJ Fuse. They were doing an album. We were our first music video, and it was the whole Digital Underground crew. Shot G, everyone was there at the Waffle House. But the kid at the end of the table, who was not a star, was the one that took all the attention and was the funniest, most charismatic person at the table. And I was taken with him immediately. And thank God, when we went to the bathroom, he said, hey, I saw you guys' short films. I'm going to get you to direct my first music video. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. It's our first music video. I don't believe this guy, you know. And the next day was our first professional shoot day. And I just kept asking and waiting, where's Tupac? Where's Tupac? Where's Tupac? Until he showed up, we didn't start shooting. And we did a scene and put him right in the middle of it. And that began like an intense year-long relationship, which included the three music videos we did for his debut album, Tupacalypse Now. And we used to always pick him up at the Burbank airport. We were really tight. So this wasn't just a professional relationship. This was a friendship as well, you know?
Yeah. Now, originally this project, I heard, was supposed to be called Outlaw.
Yep.
But at some point you decided you wanted a Afeni Shakur to be a part of this too. And the focus of it changed and the name changed. Can you talk a little bit about why you thought it was so important to include his mother in this story?
Well, for one, it was something I related to. I was raised by a single activist mother. She was at the forefront of the women's rights movement, my mother. And we were on welfare. We were, you know, we were not well off. So I relate to those struggles, and I relate to, I see everything, my mom being a feminist and raising us to be feminists, I see the world through the prism mostly of women. And so for me, that was my end. I'm like, if I can't tell this story through Afeni, and discover Tupac through Afeni, then it's not worth doing. Plus, there's dozens of Tupac documentaries, most of them dealing with the salacious death row stuff and a murder investigation. But, you know, you have to, like, what's my approach here that's going to open this up to not just his fans, but to more people, that bring more people in the tent, families, mothers, grandmothers, grandfathers, fathers, you know, like, my mission always is to, like, how do we make this more of an inclusive journey? And that's going to be through Afeni's journey.
Right. And her background in the Black Panthers also sets up this really interesting tension between Tupac's legacy as a possible leader, as an activist in the Black Panthers, and his desire and ambitions as a performer, as a rapper, as an actor.
Yeah.
And how did you sort of get at those two things and make sure that people understood how he was torn between those two poles?
Well, you can see it once you start excavating all the footage and when he was on track and when he was acting out. And he's so, again, he's so available to whatever thought or emotion. He'll say it. He says it. you know, the struggle, the identity crisis he was having. And you see it in his art. You see it in his work. You see, as I say, Tupac signed his record deal, I think, 3 years too late, because the stuff he was talking about, as far as like all the like social justice stuff and the African centric stuff, that was 88, 87. That was happening in hip hop, you know, the X Clan and a lot of, you know, Public Enemy. A lot of those groups are really thriving, you know, with those social KRS-One social justice messages. Right. Come 91, when he signed his deal, it was NWA's second album, It's for Life. And it is all gangster rap. That's all anyone's concerned about. So you saw him struggle his first two albums with the social conscious stuff, the social justice stuff. And then ultimately, you see what happened. He had to come meet people in the streets in order to get his message across. And maybe he got a little lost in that street culture, too.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about where the project landed. It's at FX.
Yep.
And FX does have, you know, some great Black Center shows like Atlanta, Kindred. But, you know, you don't necessarily think of FX as like a destination for Black-focused entertainment. So what made you think that FX would be the place for this docuseries to land?
Well, there was a few things. I went out and pitched the idea to all the prominent streamers and cablers that, you know, I thought would be a good home for this. And I was always going to go with the one that provided the most resources to make it and also like understood how to market it and position it so it would cut through. But the deciding factor for me was, first of all, the offer they made showed me they were serious, right? And it was a big deal at the time. It was an unprecedented deal at the time. When John Landgraf, the head of FX, expressed to me that the reason why they bought it was because the Afeni angle, that's when I knew this was the right place. And I was always impressed, especially these last few years, with the way they market the quality of their shows from Atlanta to Snowfall. The way they do Black television is very artful, but the way they market their shows too was a big deal to me. And a lot of those marketing campaigns they do are like art unto themselves. So I felt it was the perfect place for Tupac.
Coming up after the break, Alan Hughes talks about the challenges of humanizing a legendary figure in his documentary series, Dear Mama. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Having directed such films as Menace to Society and The Book of Eli, as well as the 2017 docuseries The Defiant Ones, Alan Hughes knows how to tell a compelling story. His latest project, Dear Mama, takes an intimate look at the relationship between Tupac Shakur and his mother, Afeni Shakur. With help from the late rapper's estate, Hughes wove together archival film and fresh interviews with family and friends, including Afeni's sister, Gloria Jean.
I have a revolutionary story that I must tell.
My mother was a Black Panther, and she was really involved in the movement. My mother is totally brilliant.
She knew freedom wouldn't come in her lifetime, just like I know that it won't come in mine.
Fanny wanted the story told, blemishes and all.
You all appreciate it.
NPR's Eric Deggans spoke to Alan Hughes about sourcing the archival footage.
What blew me away about parts of this docuseries, it felt like some of the material you got was so special. Like to hear Afeni talking about how she doesn't like jails or delivering some of her innermost thoughts. We don't really get to hear from her much in other documentaries. And you found audio of her talking. How'd you find this material that feels like we hadn't heard it before, that feels very special?
Well, some of it was out there already on the Tupac side. There's stuff we discovered on the Tupac side that wasn't out there. But on the Afeni side, there wasn't a lot out there. and to discover, you know, especially back in her Panther days, even the film footage you see or the actual photos, a lot of those didn't exist before we dug them up, you know, in any documentaries. And all the audio from Afeni was mostly interviews she did after Tupac died or speaking engagements she did at colleges. And the challenge with that was, God bless her, because she always put him on a pedestal and rarely talked about her own journey. So that was very difficult to find her talking anything about her adolescence in New York, performing arts school, all the way up through the Panthers and the Panther 21 trial and post the Panther 21 trial when Tupac was born. There's a lot of her journey that she never expressed. And we were lucky to find bits and pieces that make it seem like there was a lot, but there just wasn't a lot on her side.
Now, Tupac was killed in 1996.
Yep.
And it seems like his legend has only grown.
Yep.
I've seen you talk about balancing sort of the myth of his life and his legend with the reality, particularly in this docuseries. Can you talk a little bit about navigating that and how you balanced sorting through all the myths about his life and trying to communicate the reality of what actually existed?
That's a great question, because you got to be careful when it's somebody is so revered and becomes so mythical and the stories become so mythical, whether it's the shooting of the two off-duty white police officers in Atlanta or getting shot 5 times at the Quad Studio or a host of other things, and especially in the Death Row era. And I think the thing that I discovered is there's truth to all of the mythology. It's all based in truth. So it's just the shades when you start to unpack some of it. And, you know, you got to have a sense of humor about it or none of it works either. You know, if you're just being all clinical, Mr. Journalist the whole time. And that's where I think this medium is changing, where we're showing people that, you know, documentary filmmaking always historically was an offshoot of serious journalism, you know. And I think what's now happening is there's a handful of filmmakers coming in and showing that, you know, this stuff can be really entertaining. It could be funny. It could be tear jerking, you know, whatever films are, you know, and whatever life is. So I took all that into account in demystifying certain things. But also sometimes the more you unpack the mythology and the more you bring the subject down to earth where people can relate to him. I did this in Defiant once. And then once they connect to him as a human being, then you can soar right back out to the stars again. And it's even more of an emotional journey. So my job is not to completely like debunk everything. My job is to bring him down to earth, humanize him so everyone can connect to him, and then just rock it out into the universe again.
Now, we're at a time in media where there are a lot of docuseries about big artists that are created by or overseen by the artist or overseen by their estate.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it can be hard to be as honest as you want to be about the subject when you know that the subject is involved.
Yeah.
So you're working with his estate. You're working with his relatives. How tough was that to say what you wanted to say about Tupac, also knowing that his family was involved and they might not be comfortable with what you wanted to say?
Well, first off, before I answer that, any artist today that's living and is producing their own documentary on their life and they get a credit, I don't think that's a good thing. If you got to do a documentary on your life and you're a living artist, you make sure you get a great filmmaker that's going to challenge you and make the journey worth taking. So that being said, with being there is a Tupac estate and there is the family, and we definitely had to partner with them because of all the access, clearly. For the most part, it wasn't that difficult. And there were times where it was difficult, where they felt that something shouldn't be in there, or they weren't comfortable with something in there. And it was, you know, but to their credit, it was always a discussion. It was never like a mandate. It was always just, why do you want this? Why is it so important to you? It was always a discussion.
One of the things that I found really striking, too, was how you use Mike Tyson. I mean, you've got a lot of great subjects in this doc. You've got Snoop Dogg, you got Eminem, you got a lot of cool people. But you bring in Mike Tyson to sort of describe the mindset that Tupac was in the night that he was killed.
Yeah.
And the attraction to violence.
Yes.
So could you talk a little bit about how you use Mike Tyson in particular to sort of give the audience a window into what Tupac was feeling on the night he died?
You know, Mike, you got to give him a credit, because here's another, the other end of the spectrum, a guy that's available to whatever emotion he's in. He's very primal, Mike, obviously, right? But who has experienced more life that's alive today in our culture than Mike Tyson? Who has come from the bottom and seen the best and the worst, but Mike Tyson? And he's also become quite the philosopher, and I don't think people tap into that enough. So that's what I was tapping into. Like, what is the meaning of this? Why would someone do this? How would someone do this? You know, and he always came with these jewels, and some of them were brutal. You know, like some of the concepts that he puts out there, they're brutally honest. No one in his position would say half the things he said. There's particularly one in the opening of Five that I'm not going to repeat that has to do with violence. And
yeah,
being
with
by a
profanity in there. Yeah. He said he got excited by violence. Yeah. Let's just put
he
it
was
down.
Aroused. He was aroused by violence, and the way he says it. And by the way, there was debate about whether to keep that in the film or not. I'm like, he's saying the thing. You know, you don't have to like him, whatever it is, but he's actually saying the thing. And a lot of the discussion around what we now call toxic masculinity, Mike is a great prism into that.
Exactly. So I hear you're working on some other biopics that I am really interested to hear where you are with them. Marvin Gaye and Snoop Dogg on Snoop's own sort of movie label.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah. Marvin Gaye is, the script is ready. Everything's ready. Then Snoop comes with this fast track project at Universal biopic. And I go, wow, I should probably do this first because one, I adore him as a man, like his evolution. And two, people always ask me and my brother, when are we going to do another hood film? I go, well, this is an opportunity to do a hood film that actually is inspiring and transcends the hood, you know? And I know the culture around it. And I said, let me do this first because Marvin Gaye's, while it's ready, it's a lot more complex musically and sonically. And I'm going to need to get back in game shape and do something that's actually close to my experience. And that's a Snoop's biopic.
I could never have imagined, you know, when I was a kid listening to Snoop, that dude would wind up becoming almost a teddy bear in a way.
Teddy bear. International teddy bear.
It's kind of amazing what he's done.
He is a real special dude. You just hit it. One of the other reasons I want to do the film now is because outside of Muhammad Ali, Snoop has that type of international love energy that brings people together and makes people smile. Mm. And I go, there's magic in that dude, man. There's something very magical about someone that comes from where he comes from. And when your grandmother sees him, whether they're Asian, black, white, doesn't matter who you are, Latin, they smile. 90-year-old people smile when they see Snoop.
That's amazing. And, you know, Tupac had that too.
Tupac had it in a different way. Was
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it was a little more aggressive.
A little more dangerous. You know, Snoop comes from a place of danger, but he's figured out how to become, as Jimmy Iovine says, PG-13.
There you go. Alan Hughes is the writer, director, and executive producer of Dear Mama. The series is now streaming on Hulu. Alan, thank you so much for joining us, man. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from John Meek, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.